Good evening. I think we got a quorum, so let's call this meeting into order and welcome you to tonight's meeting of the Northern Regional Advisory Council. My name is Bryce Thurgood. I am not the chair, I'm the vice chair. The chair, John Cabot, Dr. Cabot, is excused. He's out of town, so I'm going to try to run this circus tonight, so you'll have to cut me a little slack. So anyway, first of all, we'll start with some introductions, and we'll start with Craig.
Craig Van Tassel, sportsman representative.
John Blazard from Camas Agriculture.
Kevin McLeod, public at large, West Haven.
Mike Lauder, sportsman's rep, Hooper.
Melissa Wood, representing the BLM.
Justin Oliver, public at large, West Haven.
John Wall from Riverdale, public at large.
Chad Jensen, Cache County elected.
Russ Lawrence from Ogden, public at large.
Kristen Purdy from Ogden, non-consumptive.
And Justin Doling, I'm the regional supervisor. I serve as the executive secretary and I'm a non-voting member.
We'd also like to recognize Byron Bateman from the Wildlife Board here in attendance tonight. Thank him for coming. If everybody would take a quick second and turn their phones off so we can have a uninterrupted meeting. The purpose of the Regional Advisory Committee is to gather input from the public concerning wildlife management, policy rules, and regulations. The council then makes recommendations to the Wildlife Board. The Wildlife Board considers these recommendations from five regional councils and sets policy for all protected species in Utah. We'd kind of like to ask everybody to please respect everyone's right to an opinion tonight, even if it's, you know, different from your opinion, and no clapping, outbursts, you know, just try to respect everybody. And this meeting will be recorded for the transcription of the minutes. The auto recording and the minutes will be available on the DWR website. It's important when speaking, please speak into the microphones and clearly. The public will use the microphone located at the front center of the audience. Speakers, make sure you state your name and, if they wish, where they are from. So. And we might interrupt you if it's not loud enough, so Jody can make sure we get it on the minutes. So, start off with the agenda for tonight's meeting. If there is no objections, we will approve the agenda for tonight's meeting. Okay. Being no objections, the agenda for tonight's meeting is approved. The next one is the minutes from the previous meeting. And I know they got sent out late tonight. I didn't know if I was the only one that hadn't seen them for the last couple days, but they got sent out today. And if everybody's had a chance to look at them, and if there are any corrections to the minutes? Does anybody have any corrections? Okay. Seeing none, then we'll approve the minutes as circulated. Next business is the Wildlife Board update, and Justin is going to do the Wildlife Board update for us.
Okay, thank you, Bryce, and welcome everybody to the RAC meeting tonight. It was a pretty short board meeting. The live lobster rule amendments were approved as presented. For the black bear rule recommendations, the two-week baiting season, pre-baiting season recommendation that came from the public was accepted into the rule. So there now will be a two-week pre-bait season for bear. and that was consistent with what our RAC recommended that the Wildlife Board approve. The other motion that came out of the Wildlife Board was that the they approved keeping the same start date on the La Salle and San Juan units, but restrict the use of hounds during the 9-day limited entry elk hunt. There was another motion to approve keeping the numbers of black bear permits on the beaver unit the same as last year. And then essentially a motion to approve the balance of the division's recommendation. And then if you remember, we had the sage-grouse translocation presentation here at our RAC, and we recommended that that be approved by the Wildlife Board, and the Wildlife Board did approve that. So unless there's any questions, that's kind of the update on what happened at the Wildlife Board.
Any questions on the Wildlife Board? Okay. Well, Justin's going to do the regional update again. So.
Okay, quickly moving through what's going on in our region, I'll just highlight some activities in each one of our sections. Our aquatic section recently finished up collecting about 10 million eggs from walleye at Willard. They actually hand spawned those eggs and fertilized those eggs on site. They were transported to one of our division hatcheries, and those fish were a portion of those fish were pressure treated to sterilize them to produce a sterile strain of walleye. And those sterile walleye will be going to Red Fleet Reservoir, and then there's a good portion of them that were not pressure treated, and they'll remain fertile, and they'll go back into Willard Bay. The aquatic section also has a new program that's coming out. It's called the Cut Slam. It's a program you can sign up for. Adults pay a nominal fee of $20, and the youth pay $10 to sign up for the program, and then the proceeds from that program go back into cutthroat trout management. And we have four native cutthroat trout here in Utah. We have the Bear River, the Yellowstone, which is found out on the Raft River in Box Elder County, the Colorado, which is on the north slope of the Uintas and throughout the our northeastern region, and then the Bonneville cutthroat, which is native to the Bonneville Basin. And so this program was just launched last Friday, and we have information in our regional offices and at licensed vendors if you would like to sign up for that program. Once you complete the cutthroat slam, you'll get a nice little medallion. It's got a picture of a cutthroat jumping out of the water on the front, and then on the back it's got the logo of the Division of Wildlife Resources and the logo of Trout Unlimited, because it's a partnership type program. So I encourage you to take that challenge and see if you can catch all four native cutthroat trout here in the state. Right now, fishing is good at Willard for wipers, and most of our reservoirs are ice-free, and fishing is fairly decent on those reservoirs. In our wildlife section, they're in the middle of conducting grouse counts, both sharptail and sharptail counts. If any of the RAC members have an interest in joining a biologist in the field to conduct those counts, Randy Wood would probably be your best contact, or you can contact me and I can get you in touch with somebody there. They're also in the middle of spring deer classifications to assess overwinter survival. And then they just wanted to remind everybody that the big game animals are under a fair amount of stress right now. Winter is just finishing up, and the animals are dealing with some pretty low fat reserves. So when you're out hiking or shed antler gathering or just out in the foothills, be sure to minimize your disturbance so you don't add additional stress to those animals. We do have an overwinter survival study on mule deer on the cache. We have collared does and fawns, and we're looking at those winter survival rates. And currently, the last bit of data that Darren provided me this morning was that adults are at 91% survival, and our fawns are at about 50% survival. So adult survival is really good. We're running probably a little below average on fawn survival. And the biologist will be revisiting the elk unit management plans. I think all units in our region will form a committee to to revisit those plans with the exception of our Box Elder unit and our North Slope unit. In our administrative services section, they wanted to remind everybody that the antlerless application period will be open May 26th through the 16th of June. And results for the Bucks Bowls once-in-a-lifetime draw will be available May 27th. And then general season turkey permits are currently on sale, and that season starts May 2nd. In our habitat section, the funding groups have been reviewing habitat projects and prioritizing projects and actually providing resources to complete those projects. The habitat section is wrapping up several bull hog projects out in West Box Elder. Bull hog projects are where they go in and grind the juniper right up and turn it into sawdust. And our range trend crew, which is a roving crew, will be here in our region this year, and they will be reading all our range trend transects that will be helpful as we develop our unit management plans for elk and for deer. In the Great Salt Lake program, the waterfowl management areas are finishing up their small predator trapping season. They had a couple of large carp removal projects to try to clear up the water and increase the amount of submerged aquatic plant life in those wetland impoundments. And then the Great Salt Lake Ecosystem Project is actually celebrating its 20th anniversary this year, and they'll be recognized by the Friends of Great Salt Lake at the forums issue as a friend of the Great Salt Lake. And then in outreach, community fishery events are coming up. We've got several of those events scheduled throughout the region. We've received funding to finish up the culinary water system at Hardware Ranch, so that should hopefully be done this summer. And then they just wanted me to encourage everybody to go out and look at our new Facebook page, Northern Region Division of Wildlife Resources Facebook page. A lot of current events are posted there and activities that are currently going on in the region. So if you're a Facebook person, I encourage you to get out there and take a look at that Facebook page. In our law enforcement section, we just hired our new law enforcement investigator, started about the third week in March. And our law enforcement section is putting together some pretty aggressive patrols for anglers that are snagging walleye in the inlet channel at Willard. That's where the Weber River is diverted back over into Willard Reservoir, collects a lot of spawning walleye, and of course it's illegal to snag walleye. You have to actually hook them in the mouth. So that's all I have for the regional update, unless there's questions.
No questions on the update. I failed to mention that I did excuse Dr. Cabot, and there's also three other members of the RAC that have been excused, Robert Sanchez, Matt Clark, and Bruce Silto. So, and Bruce does have a replacement here tonight, so welcome you to the... Okay, the meeting will proceed as follows. A representative of the Division of Wildlife Resources will make presentation on the agenda item. Then we'll have questions from the public on the presentation. This is time for questions, not comments. Next, we'll have questions from the council on the presentation. Then we will take comments from the public on the agenda item. Persons representing themselves will have 3 minutes to comment. Persons representing an organized group will have 5 minutes to comment. Either case, fill out a blue card if you wish to comment and indicate if you would like to address the council or provide a written comment. At the end of the public comment period, the public portion of that agenda item ends, and further public participation will only be at the request of the council for clarification. Next, the council will comment on the agenda item. Then the council will make motions recommending action by the Wildlife Board on the agenda item. Deliberate those motions and vote. Council members who wish to abstain from voting will state their conflict, and council members voting in opposition to a motion will provide their reasoning. The meeting will then proceed to the next agenda item until completed. So with that, I guess we start with item number 5 on the agenda, the Bucks Bulls and once in a lifetime permit recommendations. And Justin Shannon will be our guy.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Justin Shannon, and tonight I'm going to present the Bucks Bulls once-in-a-lifetime permit recommendations for 2016. To begin, we'll start out with deer. This past year, general season buck harvest was really high. We were just shy of 30,000 bucks harvested on our general season units. This is as high as it's been since 2000. And this graph here just kind of shows the highs and the lows that we've experienced over the last 10 years or so, dipped down pretty good from 2008 to 2011. But the last 4 years, our general season buck harvest has increased in really good conditions last year. Happy hunters, high success rates. This next slide depicts the fawn production trends over the last 15 years or so. As you can see, we took a pretty good dip in the early 2000s, bounced out of it, and in the last 7 years, we've been between 61 and 64 fawns per 100 does on general, or this is statewide. Looking at our buck to doe ratio data over the last 20 plus years or so, as you can see in the early 90s, we did have years where we were 7.5-8 bucks per 100 does, and we climbed out of that, and for close to a decade or so, we hovered around 15 bucks per 100 does. And in the last 4 years, just really sharp increases going from 15, 16 to where we are today, where we're exceeding 23 bucks per 100 does on general season units that are dominated by public land. These yellow lines on the 15 to 20, those just indicate what our buck to doe ratio parameters are, whether it's 15 to 17 or 18 to 20. The general season deer permit recommendation summary for this year, we're recommending 90,950 permits, which is 4,400 permits up from last year. Of the 29 units that we have, we're recommending no change on 9 of these units and increases on 20 of them. Starting with the northern region, we started presenting the data this way where we break it up into regional formats and tables, and it's been well received, so I think we'll continue with this. On the far left, we have the units and then the objectives, whether it's 15 to 17 or 18 to 20, and then the buck to doe ratios for 2013, 2014, and 2015. And these are important because it can show trend, and also we manage to a 3-year buck to doe ratio average. So, and one reason we do that is because, as was brought up earlier with the survival rates, if deer are having a hard year, we don't necessarily have to predict into the future what it's going to be like. These 3-year average kind of builds in some type of buffer to allow us to manage on these 3-year averages and take the knee-jerk reactions out of some decisions. On the second to far right, we have last year's permits that were approved by the Wildlife Board and then this year's recommended permits. So as you can see, for the northern region, we're recommending an increase of 1,550 permits, or about a 7% increase from last year to this year. And those units are across the board on every unit in the northern region. Moving on to the central region, recommending an increase of 500 permits, or a 3% increase. Those increases we're recommending on the Nebo and the Okra Stansberries. Moving on to the southern region, recommending increases on quite a few of these units, the Beaver, the Fillmore, the Monroe, Mount Dutton, Pine Valley, Plateau Fish Lake and Thousand Lakes, and finally the Zion, about a 5% increase in permits in the southern region. As you can see on the Plateau Thousand Lakes, that has a star by it there, and that just indicates that the weapon types might be different. And our units are generally 60% rifle, 20% muzzleloader, 20% archery. And on this one, we want to raise permits from 200 to 300, but we want those permits to occur in the archery and muzzleloader season simply because of hunter crowding, and it's just such a small area on that unit. But as you can see, the buck-to-doe ratio is 41 this last year and a three-year average of 31. Southeast region, recommending an increase of 700 permits or 5%, and those are recommended on the Central Mountains Manti and the San Juan unit. Again, the 9 mile, this is one where we're exceeding pretty heavy, and it's a unique unit where the tops of the mountains are all privately owned and the bottoms are public. So it's almost a reverse of most units we have in the state. And so even though we're exceeding, and we should be increasing tags, we're looking to do more of those in the late season muzzleloader to provide that opportunity. In the Northeast region, recommending an increase of 600 permits, or about a 6% increase. And those recommended increases would be on the Yellowstone, Wasatch Mountains East, and the South Slope Bonanza Vernal. Again, on the South Slope Bonanza Vernal, recommend taking 10% of the permits and putting them into archery as opposed to the any weapon. It's an interesting unit. They have, this last year, they were over 70% success on their general hunt with the rifle. And so we kept cutting permits and cutting them, and success rates just kept climbing. And so we've cut a lot of opportunity there. In the last 2 years, they've been above their buck-to-doe ratio objective. And so we wanted to be creative and balance that better. Moving on to premium limited entry deer, the Henrys and the Ponsagon. These units are managed to an age objective where greater than 40% of the bucks that are harvested need to be 5 years or older. And as you can see on both of these units, we're meeting that criteria. And so with that, we're recommending no permit increases on the Henry Mountains or the Ponsagon. For management buck permit recommendations, those are a little different. Those are predicated on a buck-to-doe ratio. So we manage for 40 to 50. And on the Henry Mountains, we're exceeding that at 55.9, and the Ponsagon, we're about 46. Permit recommendations, the Henry Mountains, we're recommending no increase in permits. And I get it. You look at that, and we're exceeding, and we should. It's a really small unit. And when you're dealing with an antler point restriction and taking that time to figure out is it a legal buck or not, it gets really tough to do with more hunters about. And the reality is I don't think anybody predicted we'd see 65 bucks per 100 does on that unit. So we never thought we'd exceed it this year, but maybe this November we'll bring back an additional management hunt season down there so we can spread out hunters and increase that opportunity. But on the Ponsagon, we're recommending an increase of 9 permits from 16 to 25. For limited entry, this is a very busy table, and I recognize that. On the far left, again, you have the units. Everything's managed for 25 to 35 bucks per 100 does. The buck-to-doe ratio for the last 3 years and the three-year average, and then our permit increases. Really, the thing to focus on is in the bottom right, where the South Slope Diamond Mountain, their three-year average is exceeding 40 bucks per 100 does. So we're recommending a 10 permit increase. And on the Book Cliffs, this is an interesting unit where during the any weapon hunt, we split it into the north and the south, and we're just moving some. We're recommending to move some permits from the north from the south, but overall permit numbers would remain the same on that unit. Moving on to the late season muzzleloader deer permit recommendations, we added 6 new units this year. Last year we had 46 permits. This year we're recommending 142. Some of these have pretty healthy increases, like on the 9 mile unit where we're exceeding, but those bucks are staying on private regardless of what general season hunt you have. And so that was an opportunity to get a little bit more harvest there. But overall, our units that are managed for 18 to 20 are doing really, really well. To have the majority of them exceed 20 bucks per 100 does provides a lot more of that late season hunting opportunity. So in summary, for limited entry, recommending a 10% increase in permits, or 108 total from last year. Moving on to general season and limited entry elk. For general season, we're recommending 15,000 spike permits, similar to last year, where success rates were about 14%. And also increases, we're recommending an increase on the any bull from 14,300 to 15,000. This was part of the statewide elk plan that the Wildlife Board approved in December, I believe. that sets those permits at 15,000. So we're following through with that with this recommendation, similar to the spike units. And then Youth Any Bowl, last year we went from 300 permits to 500, and that was well received. There was really good feedback, good hunter success rates, high satisfaction rates. So I told the RACs I'd report on how that went, and so with that increase, it was real well received. But no change for this year being recommended by the division. For limited entry elk, overall we're recommending a decrease of 142 permits, or about a 10% decrease. And a lot of this has to do with the statewide elk plan, where we shifted age objectives for many of these units. This is the bulk of this is a consequence of that, with a couple exceptions. For units that are managed as 7.5 to 8-year-old units, we're recommending decreases on the Beaver East and the West Desert Deep Creeks, but a small increase on the San Juan. If you look at the West Desert Deep Creeks, it's one that was managed for 4.5 to 5-year-old bull, and it jumped several age classes, and so that's what's driving those cuts. If you see a star at the end of the name, that indicates a change in age objective in the plan. 6.5 to 7-year-old units, this is probably the where we had the most movement and changes from units. So areas like the South Cache, Monroe, Mount Dutton, and Panguitch Lake, those all got moved into this new hunt unit. And as a result, there's increases and decreases throughout. But overall, we're recommending a decrease of 164 permits, or about a 21% reduction. For here, I mean, the South Cache, those permits are being cut in half to manage that for a 6.5 to 7-year-old unit, which is really what the elk plan was seeking, was to provide a more quality unit in the northern part of the state. Another one that sticks out that might not make sense with the colors here is the Southwest Desert. We've been really, really aggressive with permits down there for bulls over the last several years. And with the drop in age by almost one from last year to this year, it's one that we want to get out ahead of and make some cuts ahead of time. And so I know, according to all the data, we're still at 7.3, but we looking at the trend and where some of the feedback we got there, we think this is a prudent move given how aggressive we were with permit increases in the past. Moving on to the 5.5 to 6-year-old units, recommending an increase of 35 permits. These would occur on the LaSalle Mountains and the Wasatch Mountains, with decreases on the 9 Mile Anthro and Oker Stansberries. And then finally, for the 4.5 to 5-year-old units, we're recommending really no change in permits. Every unit's either increasing or decreasing, but we're that good that our math just worked out where it's meaningless. But the 225 permits, same as last year. So on the North Cache, recommending a decrease in permits and minor increases on the other units. Moving on to Pronghorn, recommending a decrease of 33 permits, or a 4% decrease, 771 total tags. The bulk of these decreases are coming from the units like Parker Mountain and some of those, but some of our other units are doing really well. Some of our areas in southeast Utah, our counts, things are going really good with Pronghorn in many pockets of the state. Moving on to once-in-a-lifetime permit recommendations, recommending an increase in 3 bull moose permits, 16 bison permits, 1 desert and 1 Rocky Mountain bighorn permit, and a decrease of 5 mountain goat permits on the beaver unit. And that's what I have. So thank you.
First of all, we'll go with questions from the public on the presentation. Does anybody have questions from the public for Justin? Questions from the RAC? Russ?
Yeah, Justin, I just have one question. As I'm looking through the information that was sent to us on deer herd status, and this was the same one where antlers permit recommendations were made, mm-hmm. Most of the units did show an increase. There was a few units that maybe dropped by 100 deer or so. But one unit, the Fillmore unit, dropped by over 1,000 deer. It's about 3,000 deer below objective. What do you think led to that decrease?
So, I'm not sure on the field mark. I mean, the antlerless portion will be the next presentation that we give, where we talk about populations and things like that. But the Fillmore, that unit's different. We used to have the Oak Creek and the Pavant, and what happened was is those were combined. I'm sorry, those were combined into one unit now, and the Oak Creek limited entry unit was enhanced. So there was a lot of structural change to that, and so I don't know off the top of my head, but out of all the units, that one had the most change from last year, where units are being combined, carved out for limited entry. So I don't know off the top of my head. I could look into it, but I don't have a good answer right now. So,
okay.
Yeah. You're talking populations, right?
Yeah,
why
population in general. So
I don't know. I could look into it, but I don't have a good answer for you right now. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Craig?
Yeah. Justin, I can't remember, but what was the dates on the late season muzzleloader hunt? What was the
For this year, I think it's November 2nd through the 10th, I believe. Yeah, I can look. I mean, Covey or Kent, can you guys check that on a proclamation? But I think it's November 2nd through 10th. Yeah. Actually, here, I might have it right. No, I have the permit numbers, not the dates. But we'll check that, but I think that's what it is.
Questions, Chris?
Justin, what's behind such a substantial increase in bison permits on the Book Cliffs? They went from 27 to 27 from 16.
Yeah, from 16 to 27 on the Book Cliffs.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's just a growing population. You know, this is one where I think we transplanted bison out there in 2009 and 2010, I want to say, and so that herd's slowly been growing. And so we're just trying to keep up with the growth. It's been 7, 8 years, maybe 9 years since all that was started. And so my guess is you see more of this as we get further down the road and those populations continue to increase. I think hunting opportunity would increase as well. So.
Any more questions on the... John.
On the Stansberry Bighorn permit, they didn't change, and I heard there was quite a die-off out there.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, like, what type of age class of animals died off, and if that's going to make an unhappy hunter, you know, go out there if they had such a drastic die-off.
Yeah, you're right. They are experiencing a lot of mortality on that unit, the Bighorn sheep population. What happened there was, again, this was a population that was started maybe 9 or 10 years ago, and generally with these populations, we give them time to grow and mature before we start getting pretty heavy with our hunts. And in 2012, a survey was taken, and based on the data from that survey, it was decided that 3 permits could be issued. But then we didn't survey it for 2012 till this last November. And this last November when we surveyed it, there were a lot of rams on that unit. And I think a lot of hunters had gone out there and said, guys, it might be time to turn the dial up on this, because a lot of mature rams, we're seeing them, the population's growing, which is what happens after 10 years of being on the landscape, and that's when we start to implement our hunts. So had the die-off not occurred, you would have seen a substantial increase in permits tonight from us. But when we did our survey, over half the rams were 6 years or older, which is really good, and we estimated close to 100 rams in that population, so a lot of hunting opportunity. But where these mortalities are occurring, and we think we've lost about half of those sheep, certainly we think to fill 3 permits, hunters are still going to have a great hunting opportunity. There'll still be rams on the landscape, just not at the rate that could have been, which is unfortunate. So I guess the story is we could have been more aggressive, and we weren't. So.
Was it more disease or predation?
Yeah, more disease. We found mycoplasma in the population for the first time this year. And generally when mycoplasma comes in, all these other strains of pastorella and these bacteria can just cause bronchopneumonia in the lungs. And it's really unfortunate. it's sad for hunters, and it's tough. Bighorn sheep restoration is a lot of work, a lot of effort, and it's hard when populations decline like that.
Justin?
I want to go back to the general deer permits. As you're trying to meet objectives on the different units, how is the division doing anything to take in consideration the CWMU program? And I know you and I went on a trip last week, and yeah. As you're finding areas where there's such a high percentage of it is private lands, how do you meet a buck-to-doe ratio, or how will you do that? We're trying to have them include or to ever reach that.
Yeah, it's part of your question. When we classify, are we classifying some bucks that have been on CWMUs?
And that's, no, more the question is we're trying to get the buck-to-doe ratio, and I understand raising the numbers is try to help us meet those buck-to-doe ratios, but in certain units, how can we ever achieve that if you can't, you know, on private ground, they're not going to shoot the number of deer, and that's where the majority of the deer are staying.
Yeah, if you look at the plan, it says we need to make management recommendations towards the objective. And so, I mean, with the recommended permits tonight that you're seeing, they're not, I mean, let's go back to the northern region just for a second. The point I want to make is they're not overly aggressive. I don't think there was intentions that with these permit recommendations that we're going to get from where we're at currently to 15 to 17 or to 18 to 20 bucks per 100 does. The goal is to make progress towards that buck to doe ratio objective. And so, I mean, if you take Chalk Creek, East Canyon, Morgan, Southridge, if there's a permit increase of 500 on that unit, it's not going to take us from 38 bucks per 100 does to 20, but it's providing additional hunting opportunity. And you're right, there's some units that are harder than others on the makeup, and there's all sorts of dynamics, private lands, tribal lands. Every unit has its own challenges. But what we try to do is just balance it and say, is it an opportunity unit? It's still general season. Let's provide opportunity where we think we can. And deer have grown on these units. Buck-to-doe ratios have increased on these units. And so just trying to make recommendations that make sense. So. Does that help you at all? It's kind of a hard question to answer.
It is a very hard question to answer. And I just wonder with 18 to 20, is there, I guess that age class, or not that age class, sorry, that buck-to-doe ratio, it seems like it'll never probably be the 18 to 20. It's always going to be above, and I just worry that we're going to always add more permits and then cause... Yeah, hunter dissatisfaction because of the small amount of public ground that they'll be hunting.
You know, that really hasn't been the history on these units, though. You know, we've been unit by unit for 5 years or so, 4 years. How long has it been? 4 or 5 years?
2011.
Okay. It all runs together. It's been a while. Several years. And on these units like this, we really haven't increased in the past. But our deer populations have done well. They've expanded. Buck-to-doe ratios have increased. And so I understand the fear that what's stopping us from throwing 500 more permits at it the next year, and then the next year, and then the next year. In some cases, though, you've got to look at other factors, and that's what we're trying to do is to balance it. I don't know if there's regional input. I mean, is that fair, Randy? These recommendations are made from the regions, and I'm trying to represent it as well as I can. But if you have anything to add, Randy? So.
No, Randy Wood. You hit it pretty good. If you look back over, we have always been over objective in those three units together, and we may never reduce it down to objective. And as Justin Shannon mentioned, this is kind of conservative. We want to look at things we talked about the other day, hunter satisfaction, and kind of review that, look at maybe crowding problems on a little bit of public land. And we may not see another increase in there. And you're right, it probably, I think Justin brought up, to really reduce that 32 bucks per 100 does down to 20 would take way more than 500 permits. Did that help?
Yes, it did.
Kevin?
Justin, are all of the recommendations, and are they consistent with the current management plan?
Yeah. So when recommendations come to me, that's kind of my role, is to make sure that there's alignment there. Some of the ones that are questionable that you can make a case for, I tried to point out, like on the 9 mile, you know, technically we should be recommending an increase, but it's just tough. I mean, it's one of these other unique units where we've looked at that and said, what do you do? You might add more hunters, but you might just end up with lower success rates and lower satisfaction rates. And so it's one where I've tried to point those out along the way. Southwest Desert Elk was another one that, you know, you look at it according to the plan. Should we make a cut in permits right now? So we're just trying to justify the ones that might be questionable. But yeah, I would say we're really comfortable with the recommendations following or having really good alignment with the deer and elk plans and the other plans we have. So, yeah.
Chris?
Justin, what's behind the decrease in the doe pronghorn permits? It was about 25% from 844 to 620.
That'll be a part of my next presentation that I give. But to be fair, to answer the question, it's again some decreases on the Parker Mountains where we've got some survey data back and felt like we could back off a little bit. So that's driving most of it.
So let me try one more that belongs in this section.
Okay.
What's the general rifle season success rate across the state?
You know, historically, when I first started, 2008, 2009, I was looking at that. It was in the high 20s, in the low 30s in some cases. This last year it was 42% success, which is really, really high. But that's a good thing. And that's kind of what, you know, the only way to get those increases in success. See right here, you know, the years that we were really, that we didn't get a lot of harvest, those tended to have those lower success rates. But this last year, really high. I mean, there were as many bucks harvested in 2015 as there was in 2000 with 12,000 less hunters. And so those success rates really increased. Is that going to be sustainable? I don't know. The average has been lower, but right now they're really well. They're doing really well.
Any more questions for Justin on the presentation? If not, we'll go to the comments from the public. I've got two comment cards. If anybody else has a comment, need to bring a blue card up to the front. Chris is going to watch the clock for us. I only have one comment on this presentation. John Larson.
It's good to be with you tonight. I'm John Larson with Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife. And I want to thank Justin for a great presentation. He always does a great job. And, you know, looking at 2015, it really was a great deer hunt. You've heard the numbers, 46%. That's fantastic. And, you know, in general, across the state, it really was good. It's great to see our deer herds coming back. And it's really great to see a large permit increase because that means opportunity for hunters. And that's really what we're all about. That's what we want as a state. I think anybody that draws a tag, they're going to be ecstatic about that. And if you have, you know, youth that go with you, it's even better. So looking at the state in totality, it's fantastic. But we still feel like there's a couple areas in the state where we need to take a look at maybe some problematic areas. We still feel that there's a couple of those left. And so we do support the division's plan as presented tonight with a few recommendations, and I want to talk about those specific to deer. It would be the San Juan Abajo Mountains and the Manti unit, where we're proposing a 550 increase on the Manti, and then 150 increase on the San Juan Abajo Mountains. And looking specifically at the Manti, that's an area where we have some passionate membership and some sportsmen there. And you know, if you live here and you draw a tag there, that's the largest unit in the state, and it provides a lot of opportunity, which is great. But if you live there, you're going to be a little emotional about it when you know and you feel like your deer aren't recovering like they should or where they're not around. There's a lot of deer there. It's the largest unit in the state, and there's a lot of opportunity. But we just feel like, again, listening to our sportsmen in that community, they don't see the recovery where it's a slow recovery, and so we'd like to see those permits not go forward and actually just keep them where they're at. Speaking again on the Manti specifically, you know, we've done a lot of good things, and Justin's been a great partner. The division's been a fantastic partner. That's one of our brand new recipient areas for the urban mule deer relocation program, moving those troubled deer to that unit. So we're augmenting the population there. That way it's great. It's under predator management. We're doing all the right things to get it where it needs to be, but it's you know, it's severely under population objective, and we just like to see those units stay flat to permit increase. And then lastly, the last recommendation we do have is we fully support the any bull elk permit. Numbers going up to 15,000. We have the animals to support that. That's great. Again, it creates opportunity. We'd like to suggest or propose that you add an additional 300 tags, any bull elk tags, to the youth hunt. So it's capped right now at 500. We'd like to see that go to 800. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Is there any other? Oh, Mr. Robert Burns.
Mister, it's good to see you over there in the hot seat, buddy. So,
depends on who you ask.
Robert Burns, Centerville. I would just recommend that you go with the division's recommendations tonight. We've spent a lot of time on mule deer plans and elk management plans, and we've gone through, we reviewed these here at the RAC and at the Wildlife Board. We've set up the criteria for the division to manage those species. Justin's doing the best he can within that criteria to set these permit numbers. If you look at the trends, sometimes he's adjusting the permit numbers a little bit, because you can see the trend is improving or getting worse. And so I think that's driving some of the decisions there, but it also looks forward. It's not just the 3-year average. So the other thing about permit numbers is what really drives that a lot of times is the number of bucks per 100 does. It's not the population. We're way behind in some areas, we're way over in others, but we're adjusting our male harvest based upon how many males we have versus how many females we have there. And if you're just going to leave a bunch more males in that population, it's not really going to help you drive your population numbers up. It's really going to be what our conditions are on the ground and how we're taking care of those females that are driving our population. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert. Is there any more comments from the public? Seeing none, we'll go back to the RAC. First of all, I want to commend all of Justin's helpers for helping him put this together. I'm not going to give Justin all the credit, even though he does a great job. Just speaking from a public's, you know, at large side, I mean, the division's been awesome on going out of their way and listening to public, you know, in general. And I think as far as public goes, we've got one of the best divisions to work with that we could ask for. So that being said, is there any comments on the agenda item? Justin.
First, I too would like to thank the Northern Region for all those employees of the division that work up here. As a RAC member, many of us received hundreds upon many emails on the especially the deer increase, the tag increase numbers. And as I began to receive those, I made a few phone calls, and I was very pleased that when I asked for if a few of the division employees, if they'd be willing to talk about these numbers with me, they actually not only agreed to do that, but we went on a field trip to witness and kind of teach a little bit of where the science comes and why they raise the numbers and why they do what they do. And as a comment, I know they're up to it, and I would invite anyone with questions to please call the division and talk to them. And they there is a reason for the madness and what they do and why they do, and they do a great job at it. I went with one opinion, and after meeting with them, you know, recognized why they're doing what they're doing, and I approve the increase of tags. I do have the comment I would have was with the units 4, 5, and 6 that I feel like that the East Canyon Chalk Creek, and I forget the technical name of each of the units, I feel that because of the high number of acres that are on public ground and why the high number of deer that that live on the private ground, I feel that by increasing by 500 tags may cause more hunter dissatisfaction than it will to help meet our objectives. And so my comment would be and ask would be that we could perhaps lower that number in half to 250 permits and see how the public reaction is to that, and see if there's enough room for those hunters, and see if we still continue to get the same satisfaction from hunters.
John, did you have a comment?
My comment is that, and I agree with the following of the plan. The question I have is on the limited entry elk hunts that were cut pretty drastically, I think, on the West Desert. Is that right? My concern is we already had the hunt applications put in, and people applied for those hunts anticipating the fact that probably the numbers were going to be about the same as they've always been. And so I wonder my question is there some way we can put off the application period until we know what our numbers are going to be? Or how can we handle that so that these guys that have put in with the anticipation that they've probably got enough points that they're just about ready to draw out, and all of a sudden the numbers have cut in half, and so their odds are way down. Maybe they would have applied somewhere else. I don't know. That's just an observation and some information that I got in correspondence that I thought needed to be addressed.
Well, I think a little bit, and Justin maybe can answer this, but back in November when we had the recommendation, when the elk committee met and we had the recommendations and we moved all these elk into different age objectives, I mean, at that point we knew that there was going to be, you know, substantial decreases on some of these units because we were moving whole age classes. So I would think that some of them probably educated, you know, themselves on looking at that, but some of them.
Yeah, on a lot of those units, yeah, there was a lot of conversation about movements. The Southwest Desert, that one didn't change age objectives, though. So, it's a valid point. It is a pretty good decrease in permits. The one thing that we did say throughout the process is we know it's a small unit. We know we have really, really high ages in these elk. Once we see it doing this, we are going to decrease. And I was in the region, and a wildlife manager in Southeast Utah before this job. And a lot of times during the application period, these types of people that have the max bonus points and that we're on they call us and a lot of conversations. And I know our biologists they spend countless hours on the phone with sportsmen and working through a lot of what ifs. And so I know that the application period is before these permits are approved, but in many cases that message is conveyed to those people. We don't get them all, and that's not what I'm saying, but our effort is, if we know we're going to make it a change in recommendations, we try to convey that. We try to be transparent, but in the same breath we tell them there's a public process. We don't know where all this stuff is going to land. It's a challenge.
What would happen if the application deadline were April 1st or...
Oh, you mean changing the entire structure of when you apply?
Yeah, I mean, is that just a time problem, or?
I don't understand it all. Just to be transparent,
I don't either.
our licensing folks do, and there is an entire process where we have signed contracts with Fallons and vendors that run our draw and do a bunch of this stuff, and there's a whole timeline associated with it. I don't know all the details to speak to it in great depth, but there would be some real challenges to moving it at this point, given the structure we have in Utah. So
I don't think they can do it because they do, after they do ours, they do Nevada's. And so it's back to back.
Certainly not this year or next year because of the contract.
We could trade with Nevada.
Every other?
We'll send you on a road trip to Nevada and talk them into it.
I just wondered if it was something that we were just doing because that's the way we'd already done it, or if there's a reason.
Yeah.
I don't know. Everybody out on the street that you talk to says, well, it's just because they want to keep our money longer. Right?
Yeah, the difference, we're not like a lot of states, so right. we don't charge the full price of the tag and hold on to it for months. So.
That's what I keep reminding them.
No, that's not the reason.
I hope not.
Justin, real quick while you're there, can you comment on the increase? I'm kind of been a big fan of getting the younger kids involved, and I applaud the legislature for changing from 14 to 12 this year.
Yeah.
Changing it from 500 to 800 tags on the youth hunt, would that make much of an impact, or would that make you nervous?
It wouldn't make me nervous. Let me pull it up on the elk. You're talking on the youth any bull right here, the proposal from 500 to 800?
Yes.
Yeah, so our statewide elk plan, there is a strategy in there that says, I don't know off the top of my head, but it says something to the effect of, seek opportunities to increase youth hunting opportunities. That strategy's there. Last year, we went from 300 permits to 500. The feedback was really good. Hunter success rates actually increased, which doesn't happen very often when you increase permits. Generally, they decrease. Hunter satisfaction rates were still really good. What we said last year is we would do this increase, get some feedback, try it, and see what it was. For the first year, it was certainly great. I'm okay raising it. If it were the division's recommendation, I mean, it wasn't. We didn't say let's increase. Sure. But if we were to increase, 300 might be a little aggressive. I'm okay with an increase. 300 might be a little much. And the concern that we have is not that we don't want to give youth opportunity.
Just take it slow.
It's a lot of these hunters go up on the UNS, and we don't want it to where so many bulls are being harvested out of that September hunt that we start hearing from some of the other bull hunters that feel like their opportunity is being diminished. And so it's about balance, but would an increase...
So if it was half that, you wouldn't lose too much sleep?
No, I mean, the plan says increase it. We probably just would have increased it later than sooner, but that's what RAC meetings are about, is these types of issues. So.
But you said that you did increase it 200 last year.
Yeah.
And there was positive feedback.
Yeah, and so far it's been positive.
So is there wisdom in letting it see how that settles out before?
Yeah, I would say it was kind of off our radar. I think when we did the increase, initially we thought we'd get a couple of years feedback and see what it was, but I mean, if sportsmen are wanting to increase opportunity, and I get it, youth hunting opportunities, it's great. So, I mean, certainly we didn't propose it tonight, but do we balk at the idea? No.
Craig, you got a comment?
Do you know how many youth applications you had for that?
Yeah, we have close to 5,000 youth apply for these permits, so the demand is really, really high. And that's one of the reasons we increased it last year, because we said 5,000 people applying, 300 permits, we can increase it. And the other nice thing from last year was that any bull hunter success was fine. We actually harvested more any bulls last year than we did the previous year. And, you know, that trend's been increasing as well. So I think part of it, too, we've grown a lot of elk on any bull units over the last 10 years. So,
Kevin, you got a comment?
Yeah, more of a suggestion, and it may be not even meant for this meeting. I was out of town last year when we talked about permits and those kinds of things. But I would just like to suggest and think about, and we've talked about the youth opportunity to hunt, and I'm not disparaging the draw program. We need to have a draw program, but with the With the increased opportunity in the number of deer, I would like to suggest that the state look at allowing a youth 17 and under to be able to purchase a deer permit over the counter. Too many dads that don't, and I've got family that this happens all the time. Dad forgets about the draw. Grandson wants to go hunting. Dad doesn't pay attention to it because he just doesn't. But my grandson would get his dad out hunting. So anyway, I just something that I would like to throw out there.
Can I speak to that for a second? Sure. I know this is your discussion. We do have a program in place that is very similar to what you're talking about. At the end of the hunts, if a youth doesn't draw, they can go to the general season units, and there's a cap. I can't remember what percentage it is. They can go get an over-the-counter permit, but it's valid for the archery hunt for these very things. If they put in, they didn't get it, there's still hunting opportunities available to tackle this, because I think this got brought up several years ago, and these were one of the things ways to address this very issue. If the RAC has ideas on how to build on it, great, but I just want to make you aware we have them.
Okay, thank you.
Craig?
So how's the mentor program progressing?
I'm sorry, how's the mentor?
The mentor program.
How's it going? Really, really good feedback on that. That's been one where, for those that don't know, we passed a mentorship program a couple of years ago where if your youth doesn't get a tag, but dad does, then dad can share that permit with the youth, and it's really good feedback. I haven't heard anything but positive on it. Justin, have you heard anything different?
Grandpa can also do
it. Yeah, grandpa.
I've got one negative comment about it. I passed up, I think, the biggest buck of my life last year because I was mentoring my grandson, and I didn't want to shoot one out from underneath him. It is a great program, and it was great.
Well, and that's always something we can look at, Kevin, in the future, you know, when have the hunts, you know, that we can maybe look at coming up with ways, setting aside, you know, youth-only tags in each unit or a set, you know, maybe adding to the youth opportunity. We could maybe brainstorm over that over the next 6 months because, I don't know, if we don't keep our youth involved, we're in trouble in the future. So, Justin.
On the Anybull youth, is there, I'm not sure if they draw the unit or if they draw the tag once, are they out or can they draw it multiple years?
They're out after they draw it once. Because I put my daughter in, she drew it, and then she's not eligible ever again. Is that right, Justin?
Yeah, that's my understanding as well.
And there is no point system for that, though, either, right? Just every year?
The point system is independent of the other limited entry points. Brought up in the past. Do I have to choose between putting in for the youth Anybull or a limited entry? And you can do both.
There is a preference point, though.
Yeah. There is a preference point for youth.
So
each year they put in, okay.
That's cool. Different point system.
For 5 years.
Yeah.
So, any more comments and or motions on the agenda item?
I would make a motion that we accept the recommendations as presented by Wildlife Resources inconsistency with the overall plan and adopt those changes in the number of permits as recommended.
Okay.
I second.
Got a motion and a second. Motion by Kevin, second by John to adopt the motion. The motion is to adopt the presentation as presented. I have a second. Anything to add to that?
I would like to add to my comment would be to add on units 4, 5, and 6 to cut those tags from 500 to 250 for that particular unit to help not overpopulate an area, have too many hunters in it.
Okay. So, got a
A motion for an amendment to the original motion to decrease on units 4, 5, and 6 from 500 to 250. Do we have a second on that?
I tried.
Sorry. Okay. Nothing on the youth elk? Okay. Well, so I'm going to vote on the motion as, or the agenda item as presented. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Raise your hand.
Aye.
It's unanimous. Okay. The next item on the agenda is the antlerless permit recommendations. And Justin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tonight I'm going to present the antlerless recommendations for big game for 2016. Again, we'll start out with deer. This is a graph I showed in the last presentation. Again, I just want to point out that the last 7 years or so, fawn to doe ratios have been relatively stable and high, exceeding 60 fawns per 100 does each year, which has been really good for population growth. One of the data sets that I'm probably most excited about in the entire big game program is the survival rate data that we get on mule deer. Each December, we go out and we radio collar. We catch deer, we catch does and fawns on 7 or 8 different units throughout the state, and we put radio collars on them. We get body condition scores, and then we track survival, and that's been really good. Just out of curiosity, RAC members, have any of you been with us when we've done that, when we've caught deer on the cache or any of these areas? If you haven't, come spend a day with us. It's if it lends itself to it, it's really fun. Sometimes it's difficult because we're moving stations and some of those things. But if you get a chance, come see this because it's really neat. You can actually put the ultrasound on the animal, measure fat thickness. You can get a body condition score. And we're doing some really neat things with deer that are helping us understand population health much better. So anyways, that little plug, but with our adult survival rates, we've been the last several years between 84% and 86%. We had a little dip this last year at 83%, but really average and stable over the life of this monitoring program. Our fawn survival rate, this is where things have been interesting and exciting. You know, the first 2 years we started this, we were just above 50%, which is about average for the West. And really, in some states, it's even below that a little bit in the 40s. But in Utah, from 2012 to 2015, we were hovering around 80% survival rates of fawns. And what's the consequence of that has been pretty good population growth. This graph here shows where our populations have been for deer over the last 20 plus years. And as you can see, last 4 years we've really taken off. And I know we've had peaks and valleys in our deer management, but we are riding a pretty good peak right now, and it's an exciting time. Our statewide population objective has changed. And last time this was presented, it was about 425,000 deer. But what we did is we updated our unit plans in the southern and southeast regions this last year. And with that, we raised population objectives. Deer were doing good. Habitats were in good shape. Body condition scores were good. And so thus the increase. Moving on to antlerless deer permits for the public draw. These are, over the last several years, we really haven't been very aggressive with with public draw antlerless permits for deer. Years prior, we were really aggressive. We had years where we issued several thousand permits, and we've really backed off in many cases. We are recommending an increase in permits, though, from 625 to 755, and these would occur on the Zion and the Pine Valley. And these antlerless hunts, they're designed to address depredation or rangeland concerns. And so if we have areas that deer are causing problems or where some of our ranges are really having a lot of mouths on them and potentially doing long-term damage, we get aggressive there. These new hunts we're also proposing new hunts tonight on the Zion, Northwest Zion, and some boundary changes on Circleville North and Circleville South. Moving on to elk, again, statewide population trends over the last 15 years or so. This last year we decreased elk again for the second time in a row. We're kind of stabling out at just shy of 80,000 elk. Our statewide population objective is just shy of 71,000 elk, so we're still currently about 8,000 elk over objective. But we've got aggressive in many pockets of the state. We've changed hunt strategies. We've done some different things, and that's helped. This last December, the Wildlife Board approved a new statewide elk plan and big game rule, and one of the purposes of that was to provide more tools to make progress towards population objectives. I was really grateful that the board adopted this plan because it provides more options for wildlife biologists to manage elk. And one of the changes that was made was that hunters now can obtain 3 elk permits each year in the following combination: a maximum of 1 bull permit, a maximum of 1 antlerless elk permit obtained through the public draw, and a maximum of 2 over-the-counter permits for antlerless elk. And before, it was only, you were capped at 2 elk, a bull and a cow or 2 cows, and this just provides additional elk hunting opportunities that we'll talk about more tonight. So there's 2 types of permits. There's public draw. These are your typical, you put in for a hunt, there's a season date, there's a boundary, you hope you draw it, that type of stuff. And then you have your over-the-counter permit. These are where you can come into a division office, you can go to Walmart, pick these things up. And 2 types that I want to focus on tonight are antlerless elk control permits. This is a hunt that allows a hunter to take 1 antlerless elk using the same weapon type, during the same season dates, and within areas of overlap between the buck bull once-in-a-lifetime permit and the antlerless elk control permit. The idea behind here is you can, hunters that are already in the field hunting buck deer or bull elk, they can get a cow as well, and so you can get an increased harvest without adding additional hunters in the field. Private lands only permits. This is a new one that we're going to be recommending tonight. These are permits that would be valid on private property from August 1st to January 31st on select units or subunits using any weapon. And hunters must obtain written permission from landowners before engaging in hunting activities on private lands. And so kind of the idea here is to get hunting pressure in areas that elk have sought refuge in the past. And we'll talk more about it as we explain the numbers. So antlerless elk permits, the public draw permits, we'll talk about those first. Again, we're recommending a decrease in permits this year from 15,360 to 13,680. We've steadily been declining the last several years, and that's because we've tried to explore new management options and different methods to get harvest. So a slight decrease in permits for this year. In the northern region, again, you have the unit on the far left, your population objective, the current population estimate, last year's permits, and this year's recommended permits. This year we're recommending an increase in permits from 3,285 to 3,365, and those increases are being recommended for the Cache, Ogden, Camas, and North Slope Summit. But with that, we're recommending decreases on the Chalk Creek and the Box Elder units as well. We're also recommending 2 new hunts, one on Box Elder East and one on Cache Ridge. For the central region, again, decrease in permits on the Wasatch Mountains West and Oker Stansberries, but an increase on the Central Mountains Nebo. In this part of the state, recommending 2 new hunts on the Central Mountains Ephraim and Milburn units and some name changes on West Desert Ibapaw and West Dimpanogos. These name changes, this is something we've done the last couple of RAC meetings. As we've been going through our database, we want to make sure that every hunt has a unique name and a unique boundary. And in some cases, we haven't had that, and so the name changes are needed to accomplish that. Southern region, again, slight decrease in permits from 4,250 to 3,730. Those decreases are being recommended for the Monroe, Mount Dutton, Fish Lake, Thousand Lakes, and Boulder Kaparowitz. But we are over in some units down there, and we're recommending increases on the Fillmore, the Beaver, the Ponsagot, and the Panguitch Lake. These units, we just flew, I think, every one of them but two, and so it was good to see those populations and get good data on those. Lots of changes for the southern region, recommending new hunts and boundary changes for the Southwest Desert and the Southwest Desert Northwest part. Also, new hunts on the Fillmore Pavant, Beaver East, Panguitch Lake, Markagunt Plateau, Sandy Creek, and Ponsagunt, and some boundary changes on Kasharam Valley, Fish Lake, Thousand Lakes East, Boulder East, and Boulder West. For the southeast region, recommending a decrease in permits from 3,405 to 3,140. These recommended decreases would be on the Range Creek, the San Juan, and the Manti. Also recommending a new hunt on Farron Canyon East and some boundary changes on Moreland Stump Flat and the San Juan unit. And then finally, for the northeast region, recommend a decrease in permits from 3,990 to 3,175. That would occur on all units except the North Slope, West Daggett, and Abinakwin, which are staying status quo, and the 9 Mile Anthro, which is recommending a slight increase. Also, a new hunt being proposed tonight on Mosby Mountain. And there is a correction in the RAC packet. There is a hunt proposed for the Book Cliffs, Bitter Creek, McCook Ridge, and that should have been Book Cliffs, Bitter Creek East. We made that change last year, and we wanted to continue it this year. Moving from public draw to over-the-counter permits, we recommend discontinuing antlerless elk control permits on the Wasatch Mountains and the Mount Dutton units. And then we recommend using antlerless elk control permits on the remaining 11 units. So we're not adding any units this year, we're just reducing it on the Wasatch and Dutton. And then in addition to that, we recommend 12,010 private lands only permits on 15 different units. So what do our over-the-counter permits look like? In the past, those in yellow have been permits sold in the antlerless elk control areas. You can see when we started it, recommending areas like the Wasatch and some of these others, a really big spike in increase in permits. This next year, I don't know how many we'll sell, so it's a guesstimate, but my guess is it's quite a bit lower than the 8,000. We had about half the hunters on the Wasatch and some of these other units. But with that, private lands only permits. This is, again, another over-the-counter permit and recommending 12,000. So you can see we're kind of shifting from some public draw to more over-the-counter hunting opportunities. The 15 units that we'd recommend private lands only permits are located on the left column there. And then some of the units where we're really getting aggressive with this strategy are areas like the Chalk Creek, the South Slope Yellowstone, and the Wasatch units. The Wasatch units alone, we're recommending close to 6,500 of these permits. And the idea on the Wasatch, I don't know if you guys get emails or phone calls on the Wasatch up here or not, but for those that do and kind of want to know our strategy for this, is by doing away with antlerless elk control on the public land and backing off on public draw permits and adding a lot of hunting pressure on the private lands, what we're trying to do is retrain elk and redistribute them. It's interesting. We put some radio collars out with a study we've been doing, and in the middle of October, you have twice as many elk on private land as you do public land, even though there's almost twice as much public land as there is private land. So really, the distribution of elk is not where it needs to be. And the only way we can think of to get there and to think outside the box is to back off hunting pressure on areas we want them and focus hunting pressure on areas that elk are seeking refuge. These private land permits, they don't apply to the following areas: federal, state, Sitla County, or municipality lands, tribal lands, lands enrolled in an elk CWMU, and land where public access for big game hunting has been secured, like a walk-in access property. So in summary, for antlerless elk, we're recommending an increase in total antlerless elk permits for this fall. However, we're recommending a decrease in public draw permits, we're recommending a decrease in the number of antlerless elk control units, and we're recommending private lands only permits for the first time to increase hunting pressure on private lands. Moving on to doe pronghorn, It was brought up earlier, we are recommending a decrease in permits from 844 to 630. The bulk of this decrease, again, there about the middle, close to the bottom of the plateau, Parker Mountain, recommending a decrease in permits from 600 to 30. But there are increases on the Centerfield North, Milford Flat, and Box Elder Snowville, where we're recommending two DOE permits. And again, a decrease on the Morgan Southridge, Cache Ogden as well. Well, with that said, there's new hunts being proposed to Box Elder Snowville, Centerfield North Cleveland, and Southwest Desert Milford Flat, and some name changes on Mount Dutton, Johns Valley, and Plateau Parker Mountain. Antlerless Moose, this is exciting. We're pretty excited to reinstate Antlerless Moose permits. It's a recommendation tonight on the East Canyon and Ogden units for a total of 20 permits. We haven't had Antlerless Moose permits in the public draw since 2011. We've looked at our populations, and in some areas like these, we're either meeting or exceeding the population objectives. Our moose are doing well in some pockets of the state, and others are still having challenges, but we're excited to recommend this tonight. And that's really all I have for Antlerless recommendations, so thank you.
Okay. Do we have any questions from the public on the presentation? Okay, come up and state your name.
My name's Jason Buckway. It's on the Antlerless Elk on the West Desert Deep Creek. It showed, let me find my numbers here. Anyway, we're not at objective and we're still killing cows.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you wanted to raise the age on the bulls as well. And then it said a yes to a control permit on West Desert. Is that correct, too?
Yeah, yeah.
So does that mean that every spike hunter can go shoot a cow?
Not on the entire West Desert. What it is it's carved out on the Vernon. It's interesting on the Vernon area.
So it's not on the Deep Creek. I'm referring to the Deep Creek.
No, not on the Deep Creeks, no.
Because it has a Y here on the Deep Creek on this paper, and it could be a typo.
Yeah, so on... Yeah. Are you looking at the rack packet that we sent out?
Yeah, I just want it picked up right here.
Okay. Yeah, on the West Desert Deep Creek unit, it has a star by it, and it says Antlerless control permits are only on a portion of this unit. So
is that for every spike hunter, though, that is
yeah,
anyone that buys a spike tag can go shoot cows in that specific area?
Yeah, yeah, on the Vernon portion of the West Desert, but not the others, not the Deep Creeks, no.
And... We're at 350 is the objective, and we're only at 100
last year.
And we're So I was just wondering why we're killing cows when we're that far below objective.
Yeah, so it's a good question. We're not where we want to be with that population objective, no doubt. But elk are interesting because we want to manage for high numbers of elk and manage to those objectives. But if we have elk in areas that are causing problems... This hunt is aimed at targeting problem elk that are increasing depredation issues and some of that stuff, and so it's a way to be responsive and harvest those elk, but the intent is to grow elk on that unit, but we still have to address issues.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I was just curious. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm Kurt Wood, and I like the private land elk tags, but I have a couple of questions about that. I just want to clarify, so the money, you're talking about the state getting the money for those tags, selling the tags to the state, and then they're hunting private land, is that correct?
No, the private land's only permits.
Those.
What we would do is that would be an over-the-counter permit,
mm-hmm.
But what it is it's if you have it for, say, the Wasatch West unit, you can hunt any private land within the Wasatch West unit, and you can get that permit from our division office or Walmart. Maybe I didn't understand.
So that's not turning into where the landowners are going to have the money for.
We don't issue them to the landowner.
Okay.
No, and that's why I was bringing it up earlier. The best way to go about this is to secure permission prior to obtaining the permit if you're a public draw. I'm sorry, if you're a public hunter, it's not going to the landowners. You or I, anybody could go buy one of these, but it's best to have written permission prior to buying them.
That's the other question that I would have about permission. And so if you secure permission, unlike the CWMU where they tell you what days and what areas and that you can hunt the whole unit if you get permission. And is there motivation? I know we talked about this before at the at the fulfillment meeting, but there's motivation for the landowners to let people on their property?
It probably depends on the landowner. You know, it's if a landowner is having a lot of elk on them or her and they need some harvest, there's probably more motivation to allow public hunters on. And but you have some that probably wouldn't participate in something like this. So I think they're all over the pendulum on that. But it's what it is it's just aimed at trying to focus harvest where we need it. And so that's the goal of it anyways.
Right. So would there be any way for a private individual to find out? I mean, I can see yourself going around to call. I mean, who to call to find out? Are you going to get permission before you buy the tags? Or, I mean, I know there's probably a lot of legwork to go through that stuff. But
yeah, that's what I would recommend is to do that. And you know, this is interesting because I've heard it come up. One of the criticisms of this is, well, what if I'm a public hunter and I can't get permission from a private landowner? What do I do? You know, one thing we did is we increased the number of permits a hunter can obtain. And so if you find yourself in that boat and you can't get permission, we still have lots of other public hunting opportunities for elk hunters in Utah. And so this is a very specific type of hunt, and it may not fit everybody. And I'm trying to think of a tactful way to say that, but I see private landowners and some people being able to have more options than others, but that doesn't mean that we're not trying to encourage public hunters to get out. There's public draw permits, there's spike bull permits, any bull. There's lots of opportunities.
So, sure, thanks.
Yeah, okay.
Any other questions from the public? Go ahead.
Kirk Martin, just the average hunter. To try to follow up on what the first gentleman had, has anybody contacted any of the private landowners and give them an idea of what's trying to transpire right here?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Let me talk about where this idea came from. On the Wasatch Unit in particular, this has been a major issue, and so the Central Region and Northeast Region, they put together a Wasatch Elk Committee, and this committee was talking about these very challenges, and they say, we recognize the division has to make progress towards their population objective because we're so far over. And you throw more permits on the landscape, the elk go and seek refuge on private lands, and then the public's frustrated because they're saying, you're out of elk. We do our surveys on our winter ranges and say, we're over objective, and major disconnect. And so with that committee, which had landowners on it, that was one of the recommendations that came from that group to the Statewide Elk Committee. And then when we talked about it, the Statewide Elk Plan, we had private landowners involved on that committee as well. And so we haven't been doing this in the shadows. This has been very clear with the trying to get landowner input from the get-go on this.
Okay, yeah, because I know I used to hunt the Wasatch, and I know the property is surrounded by private property.
Sure.
But, you know, I didn't want to go down and start knocking on the doors and say, hey, have you heard about this? And you know, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah, okay.
Now, my next question, maybe I was mistaken, but when you said if a private property is in a CWMU unit for elk, you can't hunt it, correct?
With the private land only permit, yeah,
yeah.
That's correct.
So now a lot of them that I've seen over there have CWMU mm-hmm. property. And there is a lot of elk there, and I know they've, you know, guide, so I know that area is off bounds. So,
yeah, the reason we didn't include elk CWMUs is because we already have a mechanism to get harvest on those. I mean, with every year there's recommendations for how many bucks and bulls should be harvested on CWMUs and then how many should be antlerless. And there's breakdowns as to how many of those permits go to the public and the CWMU. And so there's already a mechanism in place to get harvest. And if more harvest is needed on some of those CWMUs, that's a conversation to have. But we didn't want to make it convoluted by adding another program on top of one that currently exists.
So I think most of the time I've seen a CWMU sign, it does say what species is basically protected from the public then. It might have elk, deer, moose.
Mm-hmm.
Those, if this type of hunt came up, would be inaccessible to the public with this permit.
Yes, yes.
So it would save you time chasing down the rancher and finding out, nope, can't hunt there anyways.
Yeah, because if you're the public hunter and you want to harvest elk on that CWMU, put in for the public draw that goes through it. I mean, every CWMU...
Oh, yeah, they'll have one or two.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So there's options.
But that was just the question I had.
Okay.
And, okay, that was my three questions. Thank you. Thank you.
Robert Burns. Justin, the boundary change on the Snowbill pronghorn.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't we just pass that when we did the guidebook?
Yeah, that was for buck spools once in a lifetime. And so that was for the buck pronghorn. And then this is for antlerless, the antlerless portion of it.
Okay, so you're just mirroring the change we made before.
On the Snowville? What? Yeah, that's all it is? Okay, same boundary?
All right.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks. Okay.
Any more questions from the public on the presentation? If not, questions from the rack on the presentation.
Question I had was regarding the Ogden River moose, increasing to 5. I spent a lot of time in that unit. I'm quite surprised by that going up to 5 tags. Can you maybe enlighten me a little bit as to moose populations on the Ogden?
Yeah, it's probably best coming from the biologist on that. Chad, do you want to talk about that? Oh, I'm sorry, not Chad. Chad was playing that bubble game on his phone, the one where he tried to pop all the bubbles.
I'm going to pinch hit. Yeah. That's okay. And those guys know I don't know anything about sports, so I don't know what that means. Darren DeBlois, I had the Ogden unit until last year, and we had a little bit of a change in management. The big thing we're seeing on the Ogden is we're getting a lot of animals in town, and those cow, we've split that into kind of the private side and the public side. The private land side of that unit has got a lot of moose on it. And in fact, to the point where we're starting to see some damage on the mahoganies and stuff high, so like Middle Fork and above, and going north into the Cache County side. So we'd like to take a few cows off of that. We're worried about recruitment. And then on the other side, we're getting a lot of urban interface stuff. We're having to go deal with a lot of moose. We feel like we could take 5 cows.
Primarily on the Wasatch Front?
Yeah, yeah, primarily. Okay. And that's really where the public land is on that unit. So, you know, from North Ogden Divide,
well,
south.
Yeah, Middle Fork,
yeah,
Gerton.
To Weaver Canyon, basically. That's kind of where the public's going to be able to hunt. So we'd like to take a few moose off of that range, above town. And then we think we probably have too many moose on that other side. And so we'd like to kind of put the brakes on a little bit. That's the reasoning.
Thanks, Darren. Appreciate it.
Any more questions?
I have a question.
Melissa.
So for elk herd status antlerless, mm-hmm. on Ogden, the population objective is only 800, and our estimates there are on 2,300.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that population? I'm not very familiar with it, so I know there's an increase in permits this year and also the addition of the private land permits.
Yeah.
But can you talk about how we can better meet that objective, maybe?
In addition to that, we have antlerless elk control as well, which is that over-the-counter one where if you have a buck permit or a bull permit, you can go. So even though we don't have a lot of the public draw permits, I think there was an increase, though, this year on that for the...
There was, yes.
Yeah, where's it at? Oh, brother. Yeah, you're right. There are other hunting opportunities with the private lands permits, the antlerless elk control. But Darren, if you want to... Yeah.
Yeah.
happen. Historically, we've had a lot of depredation issues on the Ogden unit. We hunted cows pretty heavily on that unit, especially, you know, the Middle Fork area and around, just to try and get our damage down from private landowners. That unit was chronically under objective, and so we actually backed off on cow tags a little bit, and we feel like the increase in population isn't accounted for by births, by natural growth. It's, we've got elk coming in. I think what it's like what Justin was talking about. You take the pressure off, and elk that are being pressured, you know, to the south and the north kind of pile in. We think a lot of elk off the cache have kind of scooted over. The bulk of the elk on the Ogden unit are located from Hardware Ranch south along that mountain range to the boundary, which is the road out of Huntsville that goes up. That's where most of those elk are. And so we're trying to put the gas back on, basically, and try to address those. We think we will move some elk with this added pressure. And again, it's they're primarily on private land. And so we felt like all these different mechanisms working together might get us some harvest. We do have a track record of being able to remove elk from that unit. And so we're just trying to get back to objective. But again, you know, they elk spring up out of the rocks, but not quite to that extent. I think we just need to put a little pressure back on. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Any more questions? I got a question, Justin, real quick. Are they the biologists putting more pressure on the cedar than use to up them permit? Because I know like the Wasatch, Chalk Creek have quite a few cedar and mews, and it seemed like overall cedar and mew permit numbers for antlers never changed much, mm-hmm. because the cedar and mews, it's more of a pain for them to shuttle antlerless hunters through their properties, but it seems like that could be a bulk of the problem. So,
yeah, so, you know, with I think in December there was a new CWME rule that was taken through the public process, and some of the changes were aimed at addressing some of those. So antlerless elk hunters could have more days on the CWMEs from 2 to 3. The season started earlier, like August 1st, because some of them were saying, it is tough to harvest bulls and cows at the same time, and so we gave more of a window to harvest some cow elk and some of those options, but. You know, as far as how many permits is appropriate for each one,
yeah.
I don't know. Kobe, do you want to take a stab at that? You're probably closer to it than I am on it, but...
It just seems like, you know, we're trying to add all these public permits, or private land permits, but a lot of the culprit is the CWMUs, where a lot of the cows are hanging out.
Sure.
And that's where we need to... Because, I mean, I've noticed in the last couple of years that some of the bigger CWMUs either stay the same or decrease.
Yeah.
And it has a lot to do with they don't want to take the public hunters.
Yeah. So for those that don't know, this Kobe Jones, he's the private lands public wildlife coordinator. He took Scott McFarland's job, and you have all the answers, right, Kobe?
Yeah, all the answers. I can say that. Yeah. Before that, I was wildlife manager in the Central Region, and I struggled with some of those same issues. We did try to put Scott worked with the CWME Advisory Committee, and they did try to put more flexibility in the rule to allow for that harvest. I can tell you that I know a lot of the biologists, some of them here, are working to apply more pressure to say, hey, you know what, this we really need this to be a collaborative agreement. We really need your cooperation in helping us manage these. And my presentation on antlerless for CWMEs is next, and you'll see where there are some increases in those and where we have some decreases too, but where we've asked them to really help us out with this.
Did Scott agree?
Scott? I think so.
I'll just check and see if he
better of.
You're all right, though. It's got to be part of the equation when we're talking total units.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Justin?
With the private land tags, I'm not real familiar with the Wasatch with those units. How many acres are, is there that much ground that would,
yeah,
that these tags are going to help? And what were the dates again? August 1st till how late was it?
Till January 31st.
Till January 31st.
Yeah, with any weapon. And part of it is getting the harvest, but also you want to disrupt them. You want that activity and that noise. Mr. Chair, if it... Oh, sorry. Sunday. If it's okay, can I pull up some slides?
Sure.
On the Wasatch from a different presentation to kind of show where this would make the most sense.
While you're doing that, my concern was that these private land tags may still turn into landowner tags, because basically you're going to be paying for a trespass fee. I don't see. I'm guessing that's where it's going to go.
You may in some situations. I'm sure that may be.
But it's still public access. It's still.
Yeah, this is kind of what drove the whole decision on private lands only permits, and the question came up from the audience earlier about who was involved and why and some of this. If you look at the this is the Wasatch Unit. We didn't line it out, but what you have is the green dots. The white is private. The yellow is public. The blue is state, and the red is tribal ground. And so in the bottom left, it doesn't show up for some reason very well, but 59% of the unit is public, 36% is private. And on August 10th, before the hunts start, you have 55% of your elk on public land and 43% on private. It's close to proportionate, but there's a few more elk on private than public. And that can make sense. You know, the private lands were chosen for a reason. They generally have really good food, water, and cover. And so this is kind of the proportion prior to the hunts starting. Then you look at October 15th. Suddenly you have twice as many elk on private lands as you do public lands, even though there's almost twice as much public land as there is private land. And so you can see these elk are seeking areas of refuge onto these blocks. And then you go back, and this is where it always got interesting, is we would go do our flights in February, count a bunch of elk. They're distributed pretty well between public and private. And so that's where the lack of alignment was between sportsmen saying, you guys are out of elk. And we're saying, well, we see them on the winter range. And so we're hoping with some new tools we can... do you remember the game Pong? Yeah, like the Atari 1980s?
He's too young.
Yeah.
You're too young.
I do.
I know Mike played a lot of Pong in his mom's basement back in the day. And, that's kind of what we're doing. We're just moving these elk back and forth, and we've got to just Pong them back is kind of the idea. So.
Really quick, and we've kind of touched on it and never really talked directly about it. It is tough to harvest antlerless elk on private lands. And what we view this is when you go through the public draw, it's a chance on who gets the permit. And our hope is we can put permits in the hands of people that can actually go on the property and harvest them. And that's kind of the bottom line, is to get a tool in there, and the people that have permission can get a tag and then go on that land and harvest. I don't know if that helps a little bit.
It does.
Any more, John, question?
My question is about the cow moose. I know I talked to Dave a little bit about it, but we've been lowering and having a hard time increasing our moose population in a lot of the state. And we spent a lot of money transporting does off of Antelope Island. Mm-hmm. And it seems like if we could pull five or six of these cow moose and put them in some of these places that are way low on numbers. When I know you're looking at opportunity for hunting also, but there are a lot of people that have been putting in for a once in three lifetimes moose hunt. You know, maybe if we would move those cows somewhere else. I know the areas that I work all summer long out on the, it's in the Chalk Creek unit, but it's out by Whitney and Moffat Peak. I'll see 3, 4, and 5 bulls for every cow I see all summer long.
Wow.
So, you know, I'm just wondering if the dollars that we spend moving a doe, maybe we could spend some dollars and scoop up these problem cows in along the Ogden River or wherever and dump them out somewhere and
I think we
survive.
I think we do a lot of that. Those moose
that
come
in, you do a lot of that. I found that out, but
yeah. How many moose do you think we moved last year? Do you, any idea?
17.
Okay.
And it just what you said, took them out.
So how about doing 37 this year?
I hope we don't have 37 moose in town. That would not be good.
That's just something that came to my mind when I was thinking about the loss of opportunity for people to ever harvest a bull moose.
Yeah.
And yet we're going to be killing their moms.
What you're looking at, the moose we're moving are kind of what the ones that Darren mentioned. They're coming into town. And when you get them doing that, they're probably overusing their habitat. They don't want to be in town. And so there's enough moose to come in and do that. And they're hurting their habitat. So we're looking at, and Darren touched on this, reducing the numbers. So before you hit the brick wall, we want to start putting the brakes on it and reducing the number of town moose we have to deal with. And every one we get, we usually transfer to an area that is good moose habitat, and we try to get well away from an urban environment with them so they don't end up coming back. So does that help you any?
Do the urban moose not like it in the wilderness?
Well, they're not getting what they need, so they're coming down and eating the fruit trees.
I understand that. I just wonder in some of the areas where we are really hurting for moose if we couldn't.
And
I know you're moving, you're 17. But.
Yeah, the Camas unit, and Dave should probably speak on this, but I'll talk really quick on it. Since I took it over in the early 90s, we average in our flights about 80 moose. It doesn't increase, and we don't harvest cows there. So we're probably at carrying capacity with that area. So if we dump moose in there, they're probably going to leave.
I'm not necessarily there, but there are places in the state where over on the North Slope.
We take them there.
Yeah. Just take 20 more.
And we're also concerned there, too, about the habitat, putting too many on the willows.
I understand.
Kevin.
In regards to these private landowner elk permits, I know the division, the state and the taxpayer pays a lot of money out every year in predation. And so my question is, is there some pressure able to be put on some of these landowners that are collecting predation money to allow hunters to hunt that property if they obtain one of these permits?
Yeah, so I would say this. I think a good way to answer that question.
I haven't heard you stutter for a long time.
I'm trying to think of a good way to say. To me, this is, we've got to introduce, I see the private lands only permit as a building block. It's something we have to start and get the public and used to and the private landowners used to, and something that's established. It's really popular in a lot of other Western states. And to me, I think it's something that certainly can be built upon. I think the next step after introducing it and making sure people understand it and are used to it, the next step would be some type of incentive program that would encourage public access on private lands. You know, we have the landowner association rule that certainly needs to be revised and some different things like that. And to me, I think once we have this in place, there's more opportunities down the road. Is that a fair way to answer?
I think you're moving in the right direction. It's just some of those. I'm like compadre here. Those landowners are going to charge for access to their property, and we're the taxpayers already paying for the predation, and we're trying to control and manage an elk herd. It's got to be. I agree where you're headed. It's got to be an overall cooperation and plan, but. Hopefully we can get those private landowners on board to say, you know, give some public people access to come in and help with that problem.
Any more questions? Chad?
With the private land, with these tags, do the private landowners still get the depredation tags? And how is that going to conflict with the ones you can buy over the counter and try to get permission to hunt somebody's property.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't this won't replace the depredation program where there's permits and vouchers and some of that. My guess is this has the potential to reduce it, because if I'm a private landowner and I can go get permits at Walmart or the division office and solve my own problems and deal with my own level of tolerance on these elk, there might not be that need to come in and get the depredation permits and some of that. So, again, I think it might reduce it, but not intended to absolutely replace it.
I just see that with the private landowners is having their own private hunting units. If they already get the... I mean, I know what it's like in our area is there's some landowners who get several tags and they just give them to their family, and it just basically locks up an entire section of our county with private landowners with their depredation tags.
Yeah.
So if they're planning on getting the depredation tags, what does that do for these tags that you can buy over the counter when they're going to get their depredation tags and keep them in their families?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think in some scenarios, they might not come and get private lands only permits. I think in other scenarios where they have more elk than they're willing to tolerate and they've gone through their permits and their vouchers and they wanted some additional elk harvested or pushed, I see private lands only permits being utilized a little bit more in those scenarios. And then I think there's some that have never claimed depredation, but it would just be an opportunity for them to get a permit. And again, you know, as we went through this in the elk committee and we were talking through things, kind of the idea was for elk that can be harvested on private land, those are elk that can be grown on public land at a one-to-one ratio. And so it's all about just redistributing, providing tools. Is it perfect? No, I don't think so. And we might have some kinks and some things, but I think it's a start, and we're excited about it. You know, we've been asked to think outside the box, and this is certainly outside the box for us.
No, I think it's a great plan. Yeah. Like you say, there are going to be some snags that come with it.
Yeah.
And there are going to be some disappointed people who don't do their homework first and go buy a family full of fistful of tags and get pretty disappointed when they never get out of the truck.
Yeah, it's one reason we increase the number of permits from 2 to 3. And so if that's the case, they can still hunt that year, just do it from a different method.
Thank you.
Question, Craig.
Yeah, I have a question concerning the antlerless elk tag in Camas unit.
Okay.
There's like 500 antlerless permits, but when you look at the description of the hunts, they're all private property, primarily private lands. And my question is, why aren't some of these tags private lands permits?
I think you're talking the Chalk Creek unit?
Camas.
Oh, the Camas.
Maybe Dave can answer that.
Yeah.
Dave, jump in if I miss this. The units comprise where we're hunting the antlerless elk do have public lands in it, but it main to get through a lot, there's a lot of private access to get through there. So we want the hunter that applies to be aware that there may be some private access getting into those properties. But it does include forest. Yeah. So
yeah, but most of the elk are in the private property that need to be hunted. And that's where they need to be hunted at, is in the private property.
And that's why we put that on there, that it may be private lands. It has a big majority of private lands.
So what you're saying, Craig, do you guys see private lands only on the campus?
Yes.
We'll let it slide one time, Dave, next time you're in trouble.
I'm Dave Rich. We thought about putting it on the Camas unit to redistribute those elk, but we were a little bit hesitant to see what was going to happen, put that many people on the Camas unit. There's a lot more forest and BLM land on the Camas unit than there is on these other areas. It was kind of a little bit antsy to see how it was going to go the first year before we throw a bunch of permits on the Camas, the private lands only on the Camas. I don't know where they'd hunt on the Camas right now, other than the West Hills. So that's why we didn't do it this year. But
okay. We're
open to maybe consider it next year.
Okay. Well, I got a comment, but I'll wait till comment station.
End of our questions for the rack. We'll move to comments from the public. Is there? I got one comment card from the public. John Larson.
John Larson with Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife. We accept the division's plan as presented. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments from the public? Seeing none, we'll go to the comments from the rack. Greg.
Well, the way I see the Camas unit, I think 500 is too many tags. But I do think, I like the dates on these antlerless hunts, but I think it needs to be about 50. I think we need some pressure on these elk to keep them pushed up above where the deer are wintering and also out of people's haystacks. But I don't think we need to harvest 500 antlerless elk on the public lands there. If we can get in and harvest them on the private, I think that would be a good thing. But I think 50 would be plenty for the public lands. Just for the pressure.
Comments? Any more?
I guess I have one. At the end of the day, these private land tags probably aren't so much, I mean, it's great that we're given public an opportunity, but it's more about trying to reach our objectives and to move the elk around. So, I mean, hopefully some public lands hunters get to use these tags, but at the end of the day, it wasn't. If I'm understanding, it's not there to provide as much opportunity as to try to manage our herds and to get the elk off of there. So I know we've talked a lot about public opportunity, but I guess my comment would be at the end of the day, that's not what these are intended to be. It's more to try to meet our objectives with the elk and to move them off of private ground. So I hope it works, and I commend the division for thinking outside the box and trying to do this.
I got one, well, a comment and then maybe a clarification, but I like the idea of this personally too, getting rid of some of the elk, dispersing them. At the end of the day, if we have too many elk, would hurt the deer a little bit, so it'd be nice to get rid of some of the elk. If they have a public draw permit though, the 500 that they're proposing on the Camas, they can hunt private and public. So we're not just targeting, I mean, so we're kind of targeting both. So, I mean, it's, is that correct? So, I mean you're worried about 50 tags just on public, on private, or public, right?
I just think 500, most of that hunting, I think, will be on the public lands. And I wish more of it was on the private. I think hunting pressure is a good thing in, like, November, December, January, because I think that the elk can winter higher on some of those windswept ridges away from where the deer normally winter. I think that's a good thing, and also to keep them out of people's haystacks. But I just don't think there's that many cow elk to be taken out of there. I think it's too many. Unless they're public land permits, you know, I think we could maybe do that many public land permits, but I'm just afraid that it's all going to be on the public, and I think that's too many tags. I think it should be about half that or maybe less.
Yeah. Any more comments on the agenda or motions?
I make a motion.
John?
Yeah, I make a motion that we accept the division's antlerless recommendations.
As presented?
As presented.
Justin seconds.
I second it.
Any discussion on the motion? Craig?
Could I amend that motion and make that 250 antlerless for the Camas unit?
Can we do... John, do you accept an amendment to your motion?
All right. I really don't know that unit, so I'm not familiar with where the cows are at, you know, on public compared to private.
So you want to
private.
Keep your
yeah.
motion as... Okay. So, got a motion, doesn't want to amend, so...
Vote on the...
Okay. Craig, you could do a substitute motion for the motion if you'd like.
Okay, I'll make a motion that we accept the plan as presented, but with an exception that the Camas unit only has 250 antlerless units, antlerless cow tags.
Do we have a motion to approve the original motion as accepted with amendment of the 250 cow tags and not 500 on the Camas? Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. We're going to vote on the amendment of the motion. Yeah, John seconded it. Sorry. So we're going to vote on the amendment to the original motion of the 250 and not 500 cow elk tags on the Camas. All in favor, say aye.
For
raise your hand, sorry. This is just the amendment to the original motion. So all in favor, raise your hand and say aye.
Aye.
Two, three. Four. And opposed? Four, five, six. So motion fails. So back to the original motion to approve the division's proposal as presented. Any more discussion on the original motion? Sorry. If not, let's take a vote on the original motion. All in favor? Aye. Raise your hand. Opposed? 7-3. Do you guys, obviously we know what your problems was. Do you want to restate them?
Yeah, I'm in favor of the plan, except I would just like to see fewer antlerless tags in Camas.
Okay.
My reasons are the same. I would really like to see those elk killed on private property rather than on the public above Camas.
Okay, thank you.
And I agree with the Camas concerns.
Thanks, Chris. Okay, on to the next. Do you guys want to take a break or we got? Yes? Take a 5-minute break. Okay. On to the agenda. On to agenda item number 7, the 2016 CWMU antlerless permit recommendations presented by Covey Jones. I think this is our first time meeting you, Mr. Jones.
Yes, it is. Excited to be here today. I recognize a few friendly people. Thanks, Mr. Chair, and we'll go through the 2016 CWMU antlerless recommendations. As we go through this, we'll probably I present all the new CWMUs and renewals for this year. The others have been already approved in previous years for the 3-year COR. I also present any of the changes. And what I'll do is probably highlight mostly the changes, but then if there are any questions or anything else at the end, I'd be glad to answer those. Okay, so 60 CWMU CORs were previously approved. There are 12 that request changes to their previously approved numbers, and 10 require Wildlife Board approval for this year, Wildlife Board and RAC approval. So in summary, just as we get started to kind of highlight this program, there are a lot of positives in this program, and that is in the antlerless portion of this program, of the 1,582 vouchers, 1,264 of those go to public hunters. And a public draw opportunity to get on private land that otherwise might be too expensive or just not have access to. And 318 of those, the landowners get to keep and do as they see fit with them. So really quick, everybody knows how the split works. Your antlerless portion of the permits is determined by the buck or bull portion that you elect in the agreement with the division. So if you're 90-10, 100% of the antlers permits would then go to the public, and 34 in those. 85-15, it's a 25-75 split on the antlerless. 80-20, 40-60 split, and 75-25, it's a 50-50 split. Only one guy likes that 75-25 split, apparently. Pronghorn are always the same. It's a 60-40 for bucks and a 40-60 for the does. All right, it just stopped.
That's what I do.
All right, there we go. So just like Justin, we'll go through these by region. Yellow arrows indicating a decrease. Green arrows indicating an increase. Junction Valley, they're a new CWU, and they applied this last year with five antlers permits. So those antlers permits, they're two doe permits. So they wanted five before they ever got through the first season. They decided they could do what they wanted to do with four. The antlers permits they're requesting are mostly for depredation in the ag fields, and they feel like they can manage that with four 2-doe permits. So it'd be eight total permits. So it shows a decrease of two, but that's really a decrease of one 2-doe permit. Okay, Deseret has an increase of 30 permits, and that's because Deseret incorporated another CWMU that was adjacent, and it had 28 cow elk permits. So that's just Deseret continue to help with antlers control and elk in that issue, in that area. Twin Peaks Goose Creek, they requested a decrease of three, and the division agreed with that. That herd is getting hammered by Utah, Idaho, and Nevada, and they're getting enough harvest around the area that they felt like they could decrease harvest on the CWMU by three. Jacobs Creek, now this is a split recommendation. So the division is recommending 20 permits. Jacobs Creek went through last fall and requested an increase in their bull permits from 10 to 20. That was approved by the Wildlife Board. They got that increase. And at that time, this unit is over objective, quite a ways over objective. I believe about 1,500 elk over objective. And at that time, the local biologist said, we will be expecting you to increase more your antlers harvest. And we're presenting that as agreed. You know, we expect you to kill or attempt to harvest 20 cows. They would like to maintain five permits. So, again, division recommendation is 20. CWMU would like five. But if you go with the division's recommendation, that would be 20. Hardscrabble, another split recommendation. Hardscrabble is currently at 15 permits and in the same unit, and they requested to decrease by 8 permits to go down to 7. The unit, again, is over objective. Recent flights on both of these areas showed that portion of the unit would sustain this type of harvest. And so the division felt like maintaining that at 15 is in the best interest of getting towards our management objectives. Middle Ridge, they had a pronghorn hunt out there 1 year, and they pushed the animals out of the fields. They're not there. So we don't want it to be a bad experience for public or private to go out there and try to find animals that aren't there. They requested to take the antlerless portion out, and we agreed with that. Southeast region. Okay, Schofield East. This is the north end of the Manti, and we could use more harvest there on private lands. The CWMU asked for an increase of 11 permits, and the DBR recommends to approve that. Patmos Ridge, another area. They were a new elk CWMU last year, and another area looked like great elk habitat when they approved it as an elk CWMU. The elk just aren't. They're not there. They're not there at the time of the year that they could be harvested, even with our lengthy season dates. So we recommend taking those permits out before we have hunters that aren't very happy about that choice. Rome Cliffs wants to decrease their permits by four, and we agree with that decrease. That unit is under objective, and so it makes sense. And same with Preston Nutter Ranch. They'd like a decrease of five permits, and we can support that in a unit that's under objective. southern region, Alton, down on the Ponsagant, they're having some more elk move in, and they would like to increase their permits and increase their harvest on that. It's quite a large CWU down there. I think there are 42 landowners, but they like to, because it is dry area, they'd like to maintain, and a great deer unit, they'd like to maintain that and keep elk under control before they get out of control. So, all right, just as a quick overview, we're recommending doe deer, 9 two-doe permits, 5 single doe permits, and then 1,145 public elk permits, 261 private elk permits, 57 private pronghorn permits, and 96 public pronghorn permits. Okay, thanks.
Any questions from the public on the presentation?
Robert Burns, on was that Middle Ridge, the pronghorn?
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do for
the bucks?
The bucks.
Yeah, good question.
Are you going to help those public hunters out if they drew that tag?
So I mean we were too late in the process to change that for the buck permits this year. Probably pull them out next year. And would the biologist like to speak to that, I guess? Is there anything you'd like to add to that, Chad? Thanks, Chad. He thinks he got out of this. From what I understand, there are still a few around. Just densities are not that great. They're not what they were. They kind of just moved off.
You're welcome, Chad. You had to come hold Chad's off.
Yeah, Chad Wilson, Division of Wildlife. Do you want me to say that now, Randy, or are you talking to Cody about it?
To Cody.
Okay. Yeah, so it's, you know, of course the bucks and bulls is approved in the fall, so it does make it a little bit problematic. I think there are still some pronghorn, and I guess it would just be, unless what they work out is better, is just hope for the best on that. And then probably, yeah, if there isn't pronghorn, then removing that one as soon as we can.
They came into the CWU advisory committee meeting this year. She helps her dad run it, and just said that they thought that they could, they probably won't sell any of their vouchers, but they thought maybe they would have enough to harvest, maybe for the public hunters. So, but definitely they said they'd be submitting a request to withdraw, and I think Chad would agree, the biologist would agree with that for this next year.
Any more questions from the public on the presentation? Questions from the RAC on the presentation? Justin.
On that particular CWMU, is there a chance that those who draw the permit, they could be contacted and informed that there's a chance and then they have the opportunity to return the tag or hunt it? Would that not be fair or an idea?
I think we could do that. I mean, those that draw, we could say, hey, look, pronghorn densities here are really low. If you'd like to turn the tag back and just follow our rules and guidelines on that.
Any more questions, Melissa?
I have a question on the Deseret.
Yes.
So with the doe population, or just pronghorn in general, where are we at compared to objective?
Okay, so we Chad, you flew this. Go ahead, Chad.
that was for pronghorn, right?
Yeah.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, we flew that this spring, and actually the counts were quite low when we flew it. We flew it at the end of February. It was 250 or so. Since that time, Deseret people have been out and looking, and there's actually quite a bit of antelope out there. So last fall, so it seems like they're just migrating a little bit. Last fall they had 700 and just had antelope coming out their ears kind of during the hunts. So that's what they're expecting and planning on, is that there will be around 700, which is if I remember off the top of my head right, that's about our objective for that unit.
So when we flew it and saw that there weren't as many, we got with the operator and actually recommended a decrease. They got out on the ground and started to count and found more after that flight and said, hey guys, we think we need to ramp back up, and that's why we didn't recommend a decrease there. So we're going with the original number.
Yeah, they saw that same pattern last year too. So there was a time there where the operator, it was a different operator, but he came to me and he's like, we don't have any antelope. They're gone. But by the time the hunting season came around, they were back. So I think it's a pattern that we're seeing there.
Okay.
I believe, Chad, there are 130 permits there. Is that what the current recommendation is? I believe that's what it is.
Yeah, I think that's what it ended up was 130.
Questions? John.
So the 1,100 and something cow elk tags that are going to be put out on to the public on these CWMUs, what's the approximate average cost for a public, a person from the public to be able to hunt those cows on CWMU property?
I don't know if I understand the question.
Well,
it's just a tag.
Obviously, they have to buy the tag.
Mm-hmm.
Do they have to pay a guide fee or anything else? They just go on.
So sometimes the CWMUs will provide a guide, and sometimes they will provide a guide for free. Sometimes they provide a guide at a cost. Sometimes, but no, there shouldn't be an additional cost to get on. It is what it is. But if the public hunter elects to use a guide and their guide service costs, then he would cover that cost. Is that
okay?
And they vary on success. There are some CWMUs. I know that, just as an example, one of the CWMUs we deal with a lot, Houston East, was talking to us. Some have really, really high good success rates, and some don't have as good a success rate. So Houston East was ashamed this year at their success rate. They came in, they had 50 permits and only harvested 49. And they're just like, we're sorry we didn't get that last one. I said, calm down, guys, it's okay. So...
any more questions on the Justin?
Did I misunderstand? If they draw a CWMU, any tag, a public hunter, they do not have to pay any tag fee. Correct?
No.
Yeah, I didn't think so. I was making sure that was.
Yeah, that's correct.
That's why I asked the question, because there was a comment that the private landowners would be.
But the CWMU program is different. Different. You know, private landowners that aren't members of CWMU. Or LOA, in some ways, in LOA, they can charge whatever they want for trespass.
Right.
It's their property,
right.
And they can.
The CWMU is actually a better deal for the public, possibly than
sometimes. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It offers public opportunity at a price most of us can afford, unless we work for the state. Just kidding.
Then you can buy two bags.
No more questions on the presentation. Go to comments from the public. I don't have any blue cards, but any comments from the public? If not, we'll go back to comments from the rack. Melissa?
I have one. I'm not sure this is very appropriate right here, but I'm going to throw it out there. I was out on Deseret a couple weeks ago, and I'm a little bit worried about the pronghorn use that is happening out there on the public land. So I don't know, I feel like if they have 700 out there, is that too many? Should that number for pronghorn be increased? Yeah, just wanted to throw that in there. So should the, let me think how to say this. So there are 130 permits.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if that is too low, that there should be more.
I would say that the time to address the population objective is probably when we write the plan. And but if obviously if we're showing damage, if there are metrics that say here is damage and it is pronghorn damage, and here's how we know it's pronghorn damage. None of us would want to do damage, I don't think, to the pronghorn damage to the range.
I guess at least one nice thing is the division flew it, didn't see as many as they thought. The landowners came back and said, no, they really are here. And so, I mean, at least we're erring on the side of what the landowners, you know, increasing them, so,
yeah,
and not decreasing them like maybe could have been proposed. Chad?
Let me just say something to that. Deseret, actually, they do a really good job at exactly doing that. They try to find a really good balance between theirs. They bring their recommendations to us a lot. They have their eyes and ears on the ground and really pay attention to that. They don't want too many pronghorn. I feel pretty comfortable with that, with their recommendation because of that. Because it's like Bryce said, I said, well, you may want to cut back. Originally we cut back, and then they came back and said, no, we don't want to cut back. We want to make sure that we get the adequate harvest. So they're very conscientious of that.
Thanks. I think that turned into more of a question, but okay. Thank you for entertaining.
I guess my biggest concern is some of these CWMUs that want more bull elk tags, but yet contradict themselves and want decreases in the cow elk tags. I don't know, especially when their population's objective or over objective. I would side on the division side and not letting them get away with increases in bull elk tags and then decreases in cow elk tags. So, especially where we have a problem on private land. So, any more comments on the presentation? Or motions on the presentation? Justin?
I motion to accept the division's recommendation on the CWMU antler list permits.
Got a motion by Justin to approve as presented, second by Mike. Any discussion on the motion? Call for a vote. All in favor, raise your hand and say aye.
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 Unanimous. Okay. Number 8, 2016 CWMU antlerless variance requests.
Okay. So this is something we haven't brought before. And I think it's important to see in the rack and board process. Also, I guess I want to mention, too, that all the photos, when I put my presentations together, I get sick of seeing the same deer and elk photos. So when I put my presentations together, I send out a message to all the CWMUs, and I said, hey, send me photos, but I want photos of your public guys, the average Joe hunters that came on to the CWMU and harvested that wouldn't have had this opportunity otherwise. So you see the photos through here, that's who they are. Okay, again, so the CWMU variance request, there's a provision in the rule that allows for a variance. If you're under acreage, under, you know, 10,000 for elk, moose, or under 5,000 for deer, there's a process that you can go through and request a variance. And that variance has to go through before a CW advisory committee. And the committee is independent of the division and independent of the RAC process. And the committee gets to make a recommendation to the RAC and the board, and we get to make a recommendation independent of that. And this year's meeting, we had a few variances, and I felt like it was important to bring those before the RACs and let them know what they are and what decisions or what recommendations we had and why. So we'll do that. So Missouri Flat is a long-time CWMU. It was grandfathered in before the 10,000-acre rule and contiguous and some of these rules that we had. It's a really big CWMU. And they just barely sold their property. So Missouri Flat sold, and at the same time, Black Point, which is another CWMU for over on the other side of the road there, it sold as well. Both were bought by the same person. Ensign Ranch has bought both of those. They were told at the time if they purchased the entity, they could continue to operate as a CWMU. The owner felt like that was not the most honest way to do it. He said, no, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it right. I'll buy the ground and roll the dice and take my chances and ask for a variance. So in those two, in the and they're going to call it now the Bavant Ensign Ranch's CWMU. So there is over 40,000 acres of contiguous habitat. The variance was to include the mountain property up on the Pavant, and it's about 3,400 acres, 3,500 acres. So they brought this before the committee, and it was discussed at length. And at the end, it was a unanimous decision to accept the variance request. And the reasons why were because, one, Ensign Ranches had shown that they can operate CWMUs proficiently, effectively, and do a great job. And two, it was that the Missouri Flat CWMU had already been operated for years this way without problems. And the division, we felt like we could support that. So the committee's recommendation was to support it, and the division, you know, we felt the same way. Based on past performance of Ensign Ranches and based on past performance of Missouri Flat CWMU, we felt like it could continue to operate that way. So we recommended approval as well. Okay, another variance request brought to us by the Sandy Ranch. This is down on the Henry Mountains. Sandy Ranch is currently a member of a landowner association down there. And at the bottom, they're outlined in red with the overlapping blue. There's about 4,250 acres of contiguous land, and they need 750 more to be a deer CWMU. They need 5,000 acres of contiguous land. They do own some land up on the mountain, and it's great deer habitat. Some of it's bison habitat too, from what I understand. And they came in and they proposed, they said, look, we're willing to trade 600 acres of private mountain land on the Henry Mountains and work to acquire that other 750 through CITLA and the BLM before the three-year COR expires. And that might sound kind of crazy. I mean, obviously the CITLA purchase is something that you could see happening. The BLM purchase, you know, a lot of times it takes an act of Congress to trade federal land out of public hands into private hands. However, in the RMP, the BLM identifies this ground on the mountain and says they'd be willing to trade or sell because they want it so bad. So they would like to block up their parcels on the mountain. So they have in the plan a provision to be able to do this, which is not very normal. It sounds like a great deal. Their ranch is split between the Boulder and the Henry Mountain unit. And a lot of these deer would probably be Boulder deer that they'd be harvesting inside the CWMU. But really, the 5,000 acres, it's important. And we've got ourselves into trouble in the past when we don't hit these minimums. They are in rule. There is a process for a variance. The advisory committee didn't feel like they met it, even with the exchange. You know, the land on the mountain is great. So the next question was, what if somebody came with $1 million they were going to donate to the division, and that was the other 750 acres? And it's just like, so at what point do you start to say we probably shouldn't be doing this? So the advisory committee's recommendation was to deny the variance, but support the CWMU if Sandy Ranch can acquire the additional acreage before the 2016. Wildlife Board meeting. So we said, guys, go ahead, submit an application. Or the advisory committee said, go ahead, submit an application. And if you can acquire that additional acreage and become 5,000 acres before the board meeting, we would support you as a CWMU. And the division agreed with that. We felt like that was a good compromise. Work towards getting that land, work towards getting 5,000 contiguous, and then we can have the discussion. Okay, so the last is a variance on the Deer Creek CWMU, just right across from Deer Creek Reservoir, right by our Wallsburg Wildlife Management Area. Deer Creek would really like to become an elk CWMU. They currently have 6,700 acres. They had another parcel of ground tied up last year that would have put them about 8,100 that fell through. Now they're looking back towards South Fork of Provo and trying to reach about 8,200 acres. But still nowhere near that 10,000. And the advisory committee felt pretty strongly about this one. They said, you know, the Wasatch is one of those units where we're having a hard time meeting our population objectives. Show that you can collaborate with the division. Show that you can be a partner and meet some of those. So the advisory committee said, in 2016, we want to see you go out and harvest 30 cow elk on the property. Demonstrate that you can do that, that it's not just about bulls. work to obtain the 10,000 acres and work well with public hunters. So when people ask, you know, where can I go hunt cows? This is a place right now where, you know, this group's been told, hey, if you want to look at a possibility of CMU, allow access. And that motion passed 7-1. So it wasn't unanimous, but almost everybody felt like that was the right thing to do. And we support the advisory committee's recommendation in that. Thank you.
Questions from the public on the presentation?
Last one, Rob Burns. Kobe, did they look at doing an exchange for that private land on the Henrys as far as including public land in their boundary over on the Boulders?
So the new rule, if you're under acreage, you cannot include public ground.
It won't allow you to do it in exchange.
You have to hit the minimum before you could ever include any public ground. And that was a recommendation by the CWMU Advisory Committee. They just said, no, when you hit your minimums, then we can start to talk about boundaries and definable boundaries and stuff like that, but not until then. So the rule won't allow for that.
Okay, thank you.
Any more questions from the public? Questions from the RAC on the presentation?
Sorry. Justin. The ground that's on the Henry Mountains, was that, the ground that was on the public ground that they're looking at, or private ground that they're looking at doing the trade with, is there public access to that ground right now? I've spent time on there, and I cannot remember seeing that.
There is access, but they sell the hunting rights on it right now.
Even on these small sections of the 160, the checkerboarded areas?
I don't know about the 160, but the 640 that highlights trade, and the King Ranch and that, I believe that there are groups that have the hunting rights on that right now.
Any other questions? Comments from the public on the presentation? No blue cards. Comments from the RAC on the presentation and or motions?
Move to approve the recommendations that are here.
We've got a motion to approve it from Russ.
Second.
Second from John. Call for a vote on the motion. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Unanimous. Number 9 is R657-23 Hunter Education Rule Amendment. Kirk Smith.
Good job.
I think this laptop's on its last leg.
Well, this will be even shorter and sweeter.
You might just have to mime the whole thing.
There we go.
Mr. Chairman, I'm here to present the rule change for the Hunter Education Rule. A little brief background of Hunter Education and what's happening nationally with Hunter Education is the International Hunter Education Association is a national organization that consists of all the administrators from each and every state in the United States. And what our task is with that association is to establish the minimum standards that all hunter education programs will meet in North America. As long as we meet that minimum standard, our certification in Utah is good in all the other states, including Canada and Mexico. So this is the governing board that drives hunter education nationally. Excuse me. Prior to 2014, the IHA was focused on the traditional instructor-led type class, and they had established a minimum criteria that a classroom portion of the class would be a minimum of 10 hours. They did not address the online delivery system or method and distance learning opportunities in those older standards prior to 2014. In 2014, we adopted a new set of standards, and the IHA is focusing on knowledge-based, skills-based, rather than just spending time in a chair and being lectured to and watching a bunch of videos that were produced in 1960. So we adopted those standards. They're based on knowing safety, responsibility, and legal. And so we want the students to come out with this knowledge base, the skill base, and also the proper attitude to be a responsible hunter when they go into the field. So the current rule in Utah, it spells out in there that an instructor-led traditional class will be 12 hours in length. An online field day, this is the follow-up after the students go on to the online component, they come meet with an instructor and other students, that field day is going to be minimum 5 hours. And we also have a shooting proficiency test. We are the only state that has a marksmanship test in hunter education. So what does that mean to our program? Nationally, there's been a lot of movement towards the online without that face-to-face instructor link to really ensure that student knows and understands the safety, the responsibility, and the legal laws of hunting. So what we've done is we've looked at the new standards, and we've looked at our old course outline and identified where we can trim back the nice-to-know stuff, focus on the absolute need-to-know stuff, and provide a course that students are going to want to take in a time frame that's still efficient, effective, and a good program for the students. So essentially what we're proposing with the course outline is to trim out the introduction to muzzleloading and archery. Those are nice-to-know things. So trim that out. In our basic hunter education instructor-led course, actually implement a hands-on field day requirement. Currently, it's not required. They can sit there for 12 hours and listen to an instructor lecture. But we want to implement this mandatory hands-on so that each and every student in the state is demonstrating that they can cross a fence safely. They can put a firearm in a vehicle safely. And we base this all on our hunting incidents over the past 25 years. We looked at what the cause of the incident was while the hunter was in the field. And we said, okay, with these 6 hands-on exercises, this will be more effective in reducing those incidents than an instructor just standing there lecturing. So we've reviewed the curriculum. We've ensured that it stays within the IHEA standards. It actually exceeds the standards. Therefore, what we're recommending and proposing for rule adjustment is to eliminate the minimum classroom hour time on the instructor-led course and also the online field day component. If an instructor can feel confident that those students know that material and can demonstrate that in a shorter than a 5-hour period or a 12-hour period, that's our goal, is their knowledge base and their skill base. We're also proposing to eliminate the marksmanship test of the live fire component. Keep the live fire component. Still have them demonstrate and shoot. Let's just not test them on it anymore. So those are the recommendations, is to eliminate the minimum time frames and eliminate the shooting test. It does give us some flexibility as technology changes, that we're not locked into a time frame that we have to stay within.
Thank you. Any questions on the presentation from the public? Questions from the rack on the presentation? John, or Mike.
Oh, sorry. Just have a quick question on the not testing their shooting skills. Can I, just a thought behind that. Why would we not want them to be able to hit the target?
That's a very good question. And then as we prepared this, as we studied it, and as we looked at what really makes a safe hunter, we went through all the historical data from 2004 to 2014 nationally on hunter education programs that have a live fire component and compared those to those that do not have a live fire component, and we compared the incident rates. And it was quite interesting to see what those incident rates are with and without a live fire component. So what we learned is with a live fire, the incident rate per 100,000 is 4.9. Without is 4.8 per 100,000. So it's kind of hard, based on this data, to stand in front of the legislature and say, live fire is a, pardon the pun, do or die component of hunter education. So based on this, the statistics of incidents throughout the United States.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions, Justin?
I was just going to say Bryce could have hunted 5 years earlier if he didn't have to pass that shooting test.
I just barely passed it a couple of years ago. Justin's going to get kicked out in a minute. Any other questions from the rack? If not, comments from the public? Doesn't look like anybody's jumping up. Comments from... I'll make one comment real quick. My wife is going to be really mad because she was 8.5 months pregnant and they made her shoot and do it prone. And she was not happy. So when I go home and tell her this, I'm going to tell her to send you an email. So
send me an email with the instructor's name. I'll have a chat with him about making her do that.
She was not happy. Russ.
Well, Kirk, I do like the flexibility. Having taught hunter safety in the past, you know, it depends on the class size, and there's a lot of variables there, and I do like that flexibility because you might have a class with 5 students that know what they're doing before they even get there, and you can move a little quicker through some of that material. So I like it.
Thanks, Russ.
I just got one comment. I've got an 11-year-old daughter right now. We're doing the online course, and it's been a great thing for us because I can spend a lot more time with her than she's going to get in the classroom. She'll ask me questions she may not say in front of a group of other kids. So I think the online course has been fantastic for parents who will take the time and do it right with their kids.
Motions from the rack.
I'd like to make a motion to accept the proposal as presented.
Got a motion from Chris. Got a second from Craig. All in favor, raise your hand and say yes.
Yes.
Unanimous. And that is it. So do we have... Got a motion to hit the eject button?
So moved.
Got a motion from Kevin to adjourn.
Second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.